Earth's sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, your weekly mix of science and music. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, the story of the Christmas star. NASA's Ebb and Flow spacecraft crashed into the moon on December 17th. Jupiter is at its best right now. And Song of the Week is by the Black Books. Here's your scientist soundbite.
GRAIL is the first spacecraft mission to carry instruments that are entirely dedicated to education, cameras that will be operated by students.
That's astronaut Sally Ride, first American woman in space, speaking about NASA's GRAIL mission. The GRAIL mission deliberately crashed two spacecraft into a mountain range on the moon on December 17th. More about that in a few, but first, this week's Song of the Week is Shipwrecked by the band Black Books off their upcoming release. NASA's GRAIL mission, short for Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory, was launched in September 2011 and put two small spacecraft in low orbit around the moon. The two spacecraft measured gravity and made a lunar gravity map, the best map yet of any celestial body. Aboard the spacecraft was the MoonCam, which allowed middle school students around the world to participate in the mission and take photos from lunar orbit. GRAIL A and GRAIL B were named Ebb and Flow by middle school students at Emily Dickinson Elementary in Bozeman, Montana.
Ebb and Flow!
Can't hear you!
A final experiment was conducted during the last days of the mission. main engines aboard the spacecraft were fired to depletion, and the two spacecraft impacted a mountain range on the moon within a minute of each other.
Grayley's passing over the ridge.
All stations, this is Grayley Systems. We are now at 1 minute to impact.
Systems Grail B passed over the ridge.
And Nav just reported that we successfully navigated Grail B over the ridge, and now we're on target for our impact. Grail A impact in 20 seconds.
Systems copies, and all stations Grail B systems, we are less than 1 minute to impact.
It's getting closer.
All systems, this is Grail A systems. Impact in 3, 2, 1, 0.
Data from this effort will be used by mission planners to improve fuel predictions for future missions. NASA has announced that the crash site will be named after Grail collaborator, first American woman in space, Sally Ride. Maria Zuber, principal investigator, talks about the mission from Grail Mission Control on Day of Impact.
It's actually hard for me to envision what more could have happened than has happened. We wanted to fly low, we flew low, and we learned enough by flying low that it was possible to challenge the team to fly lower and then lower yet. We are extremely proud of the MoonCam investigation, which is the first time an imaging device has actually flown on a NASA spacecraft and been totally dedicated to education and outreach. So the MoonCam program enlisted over 200,000 students, over 3,600 classrooms from the U.S. and actually 63 countries. And students have targeted over 100,000 images of the lunar surface, which are all posted online. We've extended the funding of the MoonCam investigation in order to develop more exercises to study the images so that these images can be used as a resource for years to come for teachers who are interested in teaching students about the moon, something that goes beyond just learning what the phases of the moon are.
Dr. Charles Alachi, director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, on the Grail mission.
It's improving our knowledge of the moon literally by orders of magnitude on it. So clearly it was one of the greatest success that we have in space exploration. And the knowledge of the gravitational field is now so accurate that it will enable, as in the future we fly mission, be it NASA mission or possibly commercial missions in the future, we will be able to navigate much more accurately about where do we land and how we fly over the moon. I mean, it's the same thing as here on Earth, that we have the GPS network which allow us, you know, to land airplanes very accurately. This one enables us not because of GPS, but because of the knowledge of the gravity field. It will allow us to navigate both human and robotic mission to land, basically do pinpoint, you know, landing on the moon. And for future exploration, that will be very important.
Dr. Charles Alachi, director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And we're EarthSky, a clear voice for science, heard on over 1,200 radio stations around the globe. You're listening to EarthSky 22, 22 minutes of science and music. Thanks for listening. Deborah Bird is here to talk about a great time to see Jupiter, right now. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, it's a great time to see Jupiter. It's the best time to see Jupiter. So what happened is that Earth passed between Jupiter and the Sun earlier this month in early December. And we do that every year, about every 13 months, in fact. But we did that in early December. And that means that Jupiter is still about at its closest to Earth. And so Jupiter's always bright. But around this time, it's at its brightest. And that's a very cool thing. And the best thing of all is that the waxing moon, the almost full moon, is about to pass Jupiter in the night sky. So if you've never seen Jupiter, or you've looked out there and you've tried to identify Jupiter, but you're not sure that you've seen it, these next several days are going to be a great time to look for Jupiter.
So you just look for the moon and then look for Jupiter near it?
Yeah. And in fact, well, Jupiter's the brightest thing in the evening sky now. It's the brightest thing all night long, in fact, until Venus rises in the early morning. Venus is brighter than Jupiter, but otherwise Jupiter's brighter than any other star-like object up there. So Jupiter and the moon are going to be the two brightest things in the night sky. And you should start looking for them around December 23rd, Christmas Eve, December 24th, they're going to be right next to each other. Christmas night, December 25th, if you're feeling all full from that big old holiday dinner and you want to take a walk out into the evening, you know, that would be a great time to look up in the night sky and see the planet Jupiter right next to the moon on Christmas night. And even on December 26th, they're still going to be near each other. So for quite a few nights, you'll be able to see Jupiter near the moon and identify a planet if you haven't done that before.
Awesome. So also, you mentioned Venus is going to be in the evening sky, or is it in the morning sky?
Well, Venus is in the morning sky now. And so the way to see Venus is to get up before dawn. And I know you love to do that.
Oh, yeah. Every morning.
And so get up before dawn, look toward the east. The brightest thing up there is the planet Venus. So you can't miss that.
Well, thanks. I was curious about that.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Dr. Bradley Schaefer is a professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University. Dr. Schaefer took a few minutes to speak with us this week by Skype about the Christmas star.
Around this time of year, we often hear about the Star of Bethlehem, or the so-called Christmas star. Can you tell us what astronomers actually know about the Christmas star? Was it real? Was there something in the sky that guided the three wise men to the birthplace of Jesus?
Well, we know relatively little information about it. It appears in only a relatively small number of verses in the Bible, but it does talk about a star appearing in the east, which guided the wise men to Bethlehem, where the birth of the Christ child happened. And we commemorate it even now on Christmas trees and all over the place, the stars. And so people have looked back at that skies of ancient times, trying to figure out what it could be that made it into the Bible as the Star of Bethlehem. Before the Renaissance, people took it largely just simply as a miracle. But it was Kepler, the great astronomer Kepler, who came around, and he was able to have enough accuracy that he could track back in time to the time of the birth of Christ. And he noticed that that Jupiter and Saturn passed close by each other three times within a relatively small spacing of time. And he thought that that was a spectacular event, and this would then be commemorated and remembered and recognized as the Star of Bethlehem. So that was actually the first of the ideas around there, that this triple conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter was the Star of Bethlehem. And actually, when you start looking at things, there are about a dozen different things that people can have ascribed to being the Star of Bethlehem.
I understand that you've also spoken about this at the Vatican.
I now admit that the content of my talk at the Vatican was wrong. And the realization to know that what I said at the Vatican was wrong came in 1999 when a guy named Michael Molnar, he's a professor at Rutgers University, came out with a book which showed our errors. And once you read the book, you realize, holy cow, the guy's right. The first step of Molnar's book is to point out that all of these old astronomical spectacular ideas can't be right. And here's the logic. The only people for which the nature of the Star of Bethlehem matters, the only people we have to worry about are the Magi. The Magi are not astronomers. They are astrologers. As astrologers, they could care less about all of these astronomical spectaculars up in the sky. So what Molnar is saying is that people like me had gone back and were casting our modern ideas back on a Persian astrologer, which is completely inappropriate. So that's Molnar's first point, is the Magi could not care about astronomical spectaculars, so none of them can be the Star of Bethlehem.
Okay, and so what did Molnar, did he propose a theory?
Yeah, actually he did. What he'd been doing is he'd been systematically going through and checking astrology of kings in the ancient Eastern Mediterranean, been systematically working his way around, and he only finally got to Jesus there. But he had a very long track record of understanding the ancient astrologers in their own terms. Now, modern astronomers very much correctly deride astrology. It has zero predictive value, but we should pay attention to it as a historical force, and that's what Molnar had been doing. Okay, so the question is kind of phrased in Molnar's terms, is what would indicate to an astrologer a birthday and a place and the properties of the child being born?
Mm-hmm.
And once you phrase it like that, the answer is obvious. It's a horoscope. So Molnar's realization is that the Star of Bethlehem, well, it's the only thing the Magi would have considered. It's a horoscope. And so a horoscope actually solves three of the old big problems that people have had with all these astronomical ideas. For example, the Bible says the star was seen in the east. Okay, and so people have always wondered, well, why did the Magi see the star in the east and then go west? That doesn't make any sense. Okay, and that's always been a sticking point for all these astronomical ideas. Fair enough. But astrologically, it makes a lot of sense because the term being seen in the east is an astrological technical term for the heliacal rise. There will be always be one particular date or approximate date on which the planet becomes first visible in the morning sky. And this is called the heliacal rising. So this is a very common thing back in ancient times, is noting the heliacal rising, which is in part what the ancient astrologers did too. So astrologers had particular interpretations for particular configurations they would see on their horoscopes. Undoubtedly, they never or virtually never went outside to look to see, today Jupiter is visible, yesterday it wasn't visible, we're at the heliacal rise.
Mm-hmm.
They had a mathematical formula. They knew, when Jupiter was X number of degrees away from the sun, we'll call it the heliacal rise. And they attributed properties to that. In particular, it made Jupiter much more important. It emphasized the kingliness of the king of the planets. Another conundrum that it solves is when the Magi got to Jerusalem, the Bible says the people there had not seen the star in the heavens. So the fact that the Jews in Jerusalem had not seen the Star of Bethlehem immediately rules out many of the astronomical ideas. However, it's very easily consistent with the astrological thing, because the Jews at the time were not really familiar with astrology, and many of the things in astrology are things that you can't really go outside and look up and see. However, if you plot the planet's positions up on a horoscope and look down at a sheet of paper, well, there you go. You have your answer. And so Molnar's second point is, well, what is a Star of Bethlehem? It's a horoscope, because only a horoscope would tell an astrologer the date, the country, and the quality of the person being born. Molnar's third point is to go beyond that and to search through the old positions of planets throughout over a long period of time, and he found one time when all of the astrological omens were incredibly perfect to indicate the birth of a very, very great king in Judea. And it happens on a particular day, 17 April 6 BC. And that's just perfect, because we know that Herod died in 4 BC, and we know from the murder of the innocents that Jesus was born a little bit more than up to 2 years before Herod's death, so about 6 BC, something in that ballpark. And so it all fits together perfectly. And the date is April, a time when the lambs would be in the field, which is better than the traditional 25th of December idea here. And it has this horoscope, which has many aspects to it, which are pointing to Judea, pointing to the birth of a very, very great king. And that is what would have inspired the Magi to have traveled from Persia to Jerusalem and look around from there. The identity of the Star of Bethlehem doesn't affect any of the issues of faith. And so Molnar's historical discovery can easily be embraced by people of all faith.
Dr. Bradley Schaefer. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. Special thanks to Kevin and Mary Flanagan for facilitating a studio setup for me in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks to NASA for providing audio from Grail Mission Control, and to Dr. Schaefer at LSU. Many thanks to our musical contributors, The Black Books, 100 Flowers, Sleep Good, Maneja Beto, and The Black and White Ears. For more on the science or the music, visit earthsky.org. Until next week, happy holidays. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.